Our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault. This week we begin a three-part series on one of the most ambitious works in our archive. In 1964, on the 400th anniversary of the birth of William Shakespeare, KPFK Los Angeles producers Ruth Hirschman and Lee Whiting, in collaboration with John Monteverdi, presented a comprehensive program exploring the personal life, work, and legacy of William Shakespeare. This elaborate production weaves an intricate tapestry of the time of Shakespeare to help put the work into context.
Of an afternoon when the white pennant rippled on the flagstaff of the Globe, signifying the performance of a play, the Thames was a bazaar of haggling, blue-coated boatmen ferrying several thousand eager customers cross-river to the prison district of the Clink, where the playhouses had retreated from puritanical city magistrates.
This radio documentary responded to the 1960s challenge or argument that the masterful works could not possibly have been authored by someone from Shakespeare's relatively low social station.
Underlying all this is a peculiar kind of snobbery, the notion that a man of simple origins and education could not have been so great a genius.
This program was awarded the 1965 Ohio State Award for Broadcast Journalism. We'd like to remember that this program was edited on reel-to-reel tape using razor blades and splicing tape. The complex edits are a tribute to the craft of radio production. Thanks to a Preservation and Access Grant Award from the Grammy Foundation, we can now listen again to one of the early documentaries produced for public radio. Here, then, is William Shakespeare, This Was a Man.
His life was gentle, and the elements so mixed in him that nature might stand up and say to all the world, this was a man.
Pacifica Radio presents a five-part dramatic documentary of the life of William Shakespeare, based on a research text by John Monteverdi and presented by Pacifica Players.
Critic Maurice Morgan wrote of Shakespeare in 1744, "It is safer to say that we are possessed by him than that we possess him." What possesses the modern playgoer? Above all, it is the chance to get away from modern drama that represents little more than introverted self-communion, from little plays about miserable little people. In Shakespeare, he sees characters probed in Freudian depth, without the jargon. Instead of words that plop over the footlights like dead tennis balls, he hears language that surges like the sea. The modern stage bleats with special pleadings. Shakespeare never sermonizes. His largesse universal like the sun showers on saint and sinner, fool and sage, king and commoner. To modern playwrights, man is puny. To Shakespeare, who knew all his faults, he was nevertheless the paragon of animals. To an age of anxiety, he incarnates the courage, humor, and fortitude that have always seen men through their dark nights of the soul. To a burnt-out drama, he is the ever-renewing fire in the ashes. Immortal, he became a myth. Miraculously, he was once a man.
Shakespeare led a life of allegory. His works are the comment on it,
wrote John Keats. The allegory is gap-filled, encouraging the strange game of pseudo-scholarship designed to show that Shakespeare did not really write the plays, that he was a front man for Sir Francis Bacon or Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford, or Christopher Marlowe or Sir Walter Raleigh or Queen Elizabeth, or even the bard's wife, Anne Hathaway. Amateur cryptographers have thought they found hidden codes in Shakespeare's writing, pointing to the true authors.
The first to set the Bacon thesis really sizzling was an Ohio-born school teacher named Delia Bacon, no kin. Bent on digging up the bard, she invaded Holy Trinity Church, lantern in hand, one night in 1856, only to be appalled by the question of whether she should dig up Raleigh or Barron instead. Unhinged by this quandary, she died hopelessly insane 3 years later. In 1888, Ignatius Donnelly, a one-time congressman from Minnesota, corked the following numbers game. On page 53 of the histories in the first folio, he found the word bacon. I have a gammon of bacon, which, counting downward, proved to be the 371st spoken word on the page. I then divided that number, 371, by 53, the number of the page, and the quotient was 7. According to the Donnelly Lucky 7 countdown, it turned out that Bacon wrote not only Shakespeare, but all of Marlowe, Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, and Montaigne's Essays. The Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford boom was drummed up in 1920 by a Gateshead schoolmaster named J. Thomas Looney, a proper foil for the Baconian camp's George M. Batty. The fact that de Vere died in 1604 and The Tempest, for example, contains allusions to events after 1604 puts a crimp in the thesis. But to a cultist, what's in a crimp?
Underlying all this is a peculiar kind of snobbery, the notion that a man of simple origins and education could not have been so great a genius. These theories have always been refuted in many ways, but the strongest refutation, apart from the historical record, is the plays themselves. The style is the man, the unmistakable code in which life and work meet.
On or about the 23rd of April, 1564, William Shakespeare, third child and first son of John and Mary Arden Shakespeare, was born at Stratford-on-Avon, England. The baptism of the child, recorded in the parish register, occurred on April 26, 1564. There is no record of the actual birthday, but tradition places it on April 23rd to match the known date of the death of William Shakespeare, April 23rd, 1616. It is possible that the most significant feature of the year 1964 is that it marks the 400th anniversary of the birth of William Shakespeare.
His life was a very Shakespearean mixture of the familiar and the strange, of petty peace and dark tragedy acted out against the incomparable background of the Elizabethan age. Young Will had a far better family background and probably far better schooling than the anti-Shakespearean theorists usually concede. The Shakespeares were Warwickshire farmers, but Will's father, ambitious John, moved to Stratford and became a glover. He was one of the town's official ale tasters and donned the scarlet robes of high bailiff or mayor when Will was 4. The boy presumably went to Stratford's King's School, no doubt unwillingly, since the schools of the day consisted of Latin drill, long hours, and Spartan discipline. School lasted from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., often longer in summer.
The actual curriculum of the school is unknown, and no records of pupils and marks have been preserved. And yet a vast amount of research into the organization and offerings of other schools of this period provides us with a clear idea of the general program. The bulk of the work was in Latin. The Latin grammars of John Colet and William Lilly provided the foundation for readings in Cato, Cicero, Sallust, Caesar, Ovid, Virgil, Horace, and Terence. The minutes and accounts of the Corporation of Stratford-on-Avon note that in Shakespeare's day, a student would be admitted to the school if he were
set for the grammar school, or at least was entered or ready to enter into their accidents and principles of grammar.
There was some provision for preparing students for the grammar school. The minutes and accounts speak of such preparation.
Whereby our young youth is well furthered in reading, and the free school greatly eased of that tedious trouble.
Nicholas Rowe, who attempted the first full biography of Shakespeare in 1709, says that Shakespeare's father
bred him, 'tis true, for some time at a free school, where it is probable he acquired that little Latin he was master of. But the narrowness of his circumstances and the want of assistance at home forced his father to withdraw him from thence, and unhappily prevented his further proficiency in that language. Upon his leaving school, he seems to have given entirely into that way of living which his father proposed to him.
Rowe's statement can be supported by what is known of John Shakespeare's financial history. There are clear indications of a decline in his fortunes beginning in 1571. It is entirely possible, then, that Shakespeare's education at the Stratford Grammar School was not completed. A collection of brief lives by John Aubrey, 1681, includes a sketch of the life of Shakespeare. Says Aubrey,
Mr. William Shakespeare was born at Stratford-upon-Avon in the county of Warwick. His father was a butcher, and I have been told heretofore by some of the neighbors that when he was a boy, he exercised his father's trade, but when he killed a calf, he would do it in high style and make a speech.
Certainly this sort of hearsay has doubtful authenticity, because it is so obviously what Stratfordians might choose to say about the boyhood of the great dramatist. And yet, because it squares with what we might choose to believe, it's difficult to reject.
Although John Shakespeare applied for a gentleman's coat of arms around 1576, he slipped into money troubles and was dropped from the list of aldermen. Will had not been overly prudent himself. According to parish records, he and Anne Hathaway were married post-haste without the customary three readings of the banns. Anne was 3 months pregnant. By Elizabethan standards, Anne's pregnancy was no great scandal, but her age, an antique 26 or so to Will's 18, was. The sole clue as to how they got on together is a rather ambiguous bequest in Shakespeare's will.
Item, I give unto my wife my second best bed with the furniture.
Since Will spent most of his mature years in London, leaving Anne and their children behind in Stratford, it might be argued that she had always had the second best bed.
In the registry of the Bishop of Worcester, dated November 28th, is a bond of sureties for a marriage between
William Shagspere, on the one party, and Anne Hathaway of Stratford in the Diocese of Worcester, maiden.
The parish register records the baptism on May 26, 1583, only 6 months after the marriage.
Susanna, daughter to William Shakespeare.
The combination of facts surrounding the marriage and the birth of Susanna has resulted in many questions and many conjectures. Was the marriage the direct result of Anne's pregnancy? Was it the Elizabethan equivalent of a shotgun marriage? What was the nature of the relationship between the 18-year-old boy and the 26-year-old woman? Who seduced whom? There is no final answer to any of these questions, but there are intriguing possibilities. It has been suggested that Shakespeare bore a lifelong resentment toward his wife. It has been suggested that the Hathaways were Puritans. It has been suggested that Shakespeare's migration to London was partly an escape from the clutches of Anne. Certainly, there's no evidence indicating that Anne took up residence with him at any time during his long stay in London. In the last analysis, one is free to imagine what he will. The parish register records on February 2nd, 1585, the baptism of
Hamnet and Judith, son and a daughter to William Shakespeare.
The birth of these twin children certainly argues for Shakespeare's presence in Stratford until May of 1584. The question of the unusual name of Shakespeare's only son has been laid to rest by the discovery that Shakespeare's legatee, Hamnet Sadler, was married to Judith Staunton. It seems almost certain that the twins were named after the Sadlers, and that the close resemblance between the name of the boy and the name of the hero of Shakespeare's most famous tragedy is mere coincidence. Nothing whatsoever is known of Shakespeare's activities between 1584 and 1592. In 1592, he was active in London as an actor-playwright.
The swan-dappled Avon may have been the Styx to a London actor, but the best touring companies played in Stratford. Englamored by them, Shakespeare, sometime around 1587, left for the big town and joined an acting company. As actor and playwright, Will was a quick study in success. He wrote speedily, his editors noted that his manuscripts were scarcely ever blotted, and turned out an average of two plays a year. Plots to Shakespeare were like plots to Merlin. Any borrowed tub from Holinshed's Chronicles to Plutarch's Lives would do to mix the magic in. One of the intellectuals of the day, Robert Greene, addressing his university-trained colleagues, Nash, Peel, and Marlowe, sneered at the upstart crow beautified with our feathers, but Londoners worshipped him.
One a penny, two a penny, hot cross buns, hot cross buns, hot cross buns. One a penny, two a penny, hot cross buns, one a penny buns, two a penny buns. One a penny, two a penny, hot cross buns. One if you have no daughters, give them to your sons.
The city whose temper Shakespeare had caught was in a ferment. In the quick forge and working house of thought, Elizabethan London was minting a new breed, Renaissance men. Never was the Englishman more Latin, bristling with Spanish pride at personal indignities, Italian in his boastful womanizing, French in his world-playful wit. After the Spanish Armada went down in 1588, England ruled the waves, and no one had ever so masterfully ruled England as Elizabeth I. Elizabethan was agape at the sheer wonder of himself.
What a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god.
Dazzled by life, the Elizabethan was nonetheless on familiar terms with death. Plagues riddled London. The severed heads of criminals rotted in the sun at Tyburn Tree. The acme of the hangman's art was to cut his man down and eviscerate him while still alive. A priest was once heard saying his prayers even as his heart palpitated in the hangman's palm. Ben Jonson killed a man in a duel. Kit Marlowe was stabbed to death in a tavern brawl. The Elizabethans lived dangerously, and while they lived, they were a smile with daring. Shakespeare held a magnifying glass to the spirit of his age and set the unroofed circle of the globe's wooden O blazing with his muse of fire. Of an afternoon, when the white pennant rippled on the flagstaff of the globe, signifying the performance of a play, the Thames was a bazaar of haggling, blue-coated boatmen ferrying several thousand eager customers cross-river to the prison district of the Clink, where the playhouses had retreated from puritanical city magistrates. The fops gossiped and smoked on stage, jostling one another and munching sausages in the penny standing room of the pit, where the groundlings and stinkards, men who had unfurled canvas with Drake, but could not read or write. From next door at the Paris Garden came the snarls of mastiffs as they leaped at the throat of Harry Hunks, a chained bear that snapped at them with his sawed-down teeth and clawed some into bloody silence. This was the competition for Romeo and Juliet. No one sensed the paradox in beauty and the bestial more keenly than Shakespeare.
Here with this rage shall beauty hold a plea whose action is no stronger than a flower.
Whatever role Shakespeare played on stage, some think his favorite part was the ghost in Hamlet. Off stage, he was a prudent investor and a bit of a snob. He bought a piece of the Players' Company, a piece of the Globe, and eventually paid £60 for New Place, the second grandest house in Stratford. In 1596, his father pushed his long-dormant claim to a coat of arms, and the Shakespeares became gentlemen heralded by a hawk brandishing a spear and the motto, Non sans droit, not without right, which Ben Jonson promptly parodied as not without mustard. That same year, Shakespeare's 11-year-old son, Hamnet, died. This was one of three events that probably clouded the sunlit hours of the early comedies and prologued the dark vision of the great tragedies. The second was Shakespeare's embittered love affair with the unknown Dark Lady of the Sonnets. Biographers have found traces of this siren's raven hair, pitch-black eyes, jigging walk, panting breath, and wanton ways in the characters of Ophelia, Cressida, and Cleopatra. The third event was the arrest and imprisonment of Shakespeare's patron, the Earl of Southampton, for helping Essex plot against the Queen. In combination, these events seem to have left Shakespeare at times with a bleak view of man's fate and a nausea of sex. No existentialist has found life more meaningless than Shakespeare's.
It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
The disgust with sex not only inspires one of the finest sonnets, The Expense of Spirit, is in a waste of shame, is lust in action, but it erupts with sour rancor in all the major tragedies but Macbeth. With almost prurient relish, Hamlet chides his mother not to let the bloat king with his reachy kisses tempt her again to bed. The 80-ish Lear, who might be presumed past sex obsession, works himself up into a fury on the devil in women's flesh.
Down from the waist they are centaurs, the women all above. But to the girdle do the gods inherit, beneath is all the fiends. There's hell, there's darkness, there is the sulphurous pit, burning, scalding, stench, consumption, Give me an ounce of civet. Good apothecaries sweeten my imagination.
Shakespeare's own imagination invariably sweetened itself, for in the long run he never saw only the dark side of man or woman. He retired to Stratford around 1611. His sense of evil seemingly muted, as is suggested by the enchanted isles, fairy tale plots, masks, and marvels of the last plays. For his final comment on man's existence in The Tempest, 1611, Shakespeare returned instinctively to the stage with its quality of make-believe.
Our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.
Shakespeare died 5 years later, at 52, of unknown causes, though one 17th-century chronicler reported that Shakespeare, Drayton, and Ben Jonson had a merry meeting and, it seems, drank too hard, for Shakespeare died of a fever there contracted. Anne outlived him by 7 years and asked to be buried in the same grave, but the authorities dared not flout Shakespeare's doggerel epitaph.
Good friend, for Jesus' sake forbear to dig the dust enclosed here.
The future was less considerate. Relentlessly, the dust has been dug up, the literary remains chopped, scattered, reshaped by each succeeding age according to its own vision. A history of changing Shakespearean fashions, as T.S. Eliot has pointed out, is a history of Western civilization.
You've been listening to This Was a Man. Today, the first program in a 5-part documentary of William Shakespeare's life. The players were William O'Connell as John Keats and the clerk, Richard Peel as Nicholas Rowe, Ben Wright, John Aubrey and William Shakespeare, David Osman, the reporter, and your narrators were Ed Stoddard and Lee Whiting. This program was based on a research text by John Monteverdi and the editorial from Time magazine of July 4, 1960, adapted for radio by Lee Whiting. This Was a Man was directed and produced by Ruth Hirschman and Lee Whiting, with technical assistance by Mike Dayton. This has been a production of the Drama and Literature Department of Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles.